Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to episode 261. Today we're joined with Emmett Peppers. How are you doing, Emmett?
Good, Dave. Yeah, man, I love being a regular on here. We have to have our own, like, you know, you're 260, you're on 261, you said?
Yep, 261.
We're on like number, I don't know, like 12 or 13 by now. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, we're approaching up there. it's becoming a regular thing, and it's been fun. Yeah. I learn every chat. I learn stuff, you know. I learn stuff from you, but I also learn stuff just talking and also discussing this stuff. And it's an awesome time. This past week, so it's been a crazy week. Crazy past 2 weeks.
Yes.
In the markets.
Crazy.
And so what I wanted to do in this episode is I wanted to unpack some of that stuff. I want to hear your thoughts, discuss some of our kind of outlook, how we're dealing with things. I also want to talk a little bit about the psychological approach of how to deal with volatility and fear and loss, et cetera. And then we'll go into a bunch of Twitter questions and from followers as well. So first off, I mean, I'm looking at, it's not just Tesla, but it's a lot of these growth stocks. A lot of them are down like 25% or more from their all-time highs. And there's a lot of red, especially for those who are invested in growth stocks. How have you been, man? Like, what do you think? What have you been going through? Like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's stressful, you know. Tesla obviously is, just like you, my number one holding by far in my personal account. And then I have this fund, which I'm trying to invest in a variety of mostly growth stocks. And so it's just, it's stressful seeing some of these go, you know, some of them have done all right, but some of them have really taken a hit hard, you know, like Tesla has. And it's, you know, every day you just wake up and you're like, oh man, I hope the markets aren't down so much already. You know, like, you know, it just very volatile. It kind of, you know, it reminds me of just like a major correction or, you know, something. Not, I don't think it should be as bad as it was last year from the coronavirus panic, you know. But that's my hunch, but I don't know. It just seems like we're still in the midst or the swings of kind of some volatility here, and seems largely driven by these interest rates kind of creeping up. I mean, that seems to be the consensus on what's correlated to this volatility. What's your view on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I mean, last year you had kind of a reason for, you know, the crash. You had COVID, you had mm-hmm. everything shutting down. It was very visible. And, you know, you had factories shutting down, just like guidance getting cut in half, et cetera, for many companies. But this time around, it's a little tricky because there isn't that clear, you know, catalyst. There's no financial crisis. There's no, you know, recession. We're coming out of, actually, you know, the COVID and pandemic kind of downturn. So it's a tricky thing. It's something like, hey, is this pretty much almost over, or is this going to extend for longer, and how much lower is it going to go? I mean, what are your thoughts? I mean, are you kind of leaving it up in the air, or, and also how are you at kind of adjusting things, especially with your fund?
Yeah. I mean, I've been kind of waiting for, obviously everyone's been waiting for some kind of big correction. And I always had this, you know, and I think I've talked about it on here and told lots of friends about it. Like, I always suspected like the next big major crash or correction is going to be when, you know, we've so-called defeated this virus and things are going back to normal and the economy's back on track and seems stronger than ever, where stocks are at all time highs. And it's like, everyone's like, why not be invested in the market now? And that's when the crash would happen. But I feel like it's too early for that kind of scenario. And I'm not sure that's going to play out, but I feel like right now this is, you know, I think it could just be a major, you know, pullback in growth stocks with these interest rates and kind of a resetting of valuations a little lower. And then we kind of creep up from there. I listened to Kathy Wood's In the Know, episode on yesterday, mm-hmm. last night, because I think she's kind of a forefront investor, of, you know, leading thinker on how this goes, her and her team. And they seem to think, you know, they're more optimistic and think, you know, this is very healthy for the growth stocks, and that they'll just kind of have a a new foundation to build from and go up again from here. So I hope that's the case. And you know, it's tough seeing your brokerage account get cut by 10% a day for a few days in a row, you know, like, oh my gosh. And then it comes back halfway and then it goes down 10 or, you know, it's like one step forward, two steps back, one step forward, three steps, you know, it's, you know, but that's how the market is. It doesn't just go up, right? You have to know that it goes up and down, and maybe the all-time highs that we were at recently don't come back until a year from now or something. You just have to be ready for that type of scenario. Like, none of us should be investing with money that we need to use, you know, very soon. Like, this type of investing in growth stocks especially should be like your long-term savings that you don't need for a while, you know? And I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, I think you have something similar, like you want to, you know, have a long-term outlook, right? I mean, that's sort of what you talk about.
I mean, yeah, it's interesting. This downturn or this, you know, correction in some senses. I remember it was in one of our previous episodes, I was like, this is probably back last year, probably December or November. I was saying I could see it continuing to go up after kind of the S&P inclusion, but then after a while, maybe February or so, it kind of loses its steam, you know? And that's when it's like most vulnerable. And I think last week or so, I was talking about kind of there's always this inherent risk in certain stocks. And as it goes higher, you know, especially as it goes into more generous multiples and it's the forecasts are going further and further out, they're trying to get, you know, cash flows from 5 to 10 years from now to justify today's present valuation. That's just an increase of risk that's inherently in the stock. But most people, I think, like, they're not in touch with that, meaning as the stock goes up higher, they think, hey, look at my brokerage account, it's going up higher. I'm better off, you know? And they get used to it. After like a month or so of your brokerage account being at a certain point, you're like, hey, this is great. And you're numb to that added risk. You know, the higher it goes in some ways, there is, you know, added risk of a correction of something happening. And so I think that in a way helps me a lot. Like when the stock is in exuberant mode, I'm kind of very cautious or very aware that, A, this is getting riskier. And so then when it does correct or do something, like, you know, it's kind of like half of me expected it. You know, I didn't want it to happen. Obviously, I wish it would have just continued to go up. But, you know, it's, you know, at a certain point, it's like it's granted that something like that, you know, there's a decent chance of that happening. And so...
Yeah. And you asked me, what did I do different? You know, and this time around, I didn't buy any puts or anything like that. And by the time I thought I wanted to buy puts, I just feel like it's kind of too late. The market's already, you know, come down quite a bit and I could be close to the, you know, you don't know if it's, we're in the middle of a drop or at the end of a correction. You don't really know. And, but like you were saying, as it was creeping up to new all-time highs, I did start selling like out of the money covered calls on some of my positions, you know, but just a few. I wish I sold more because I was going to play. I thought the stocks were going to keep going up and I was going to sell. I was kind of carefully stepping into some out of the money calls, like on parts of positions. But, you know, I didn't time it quite right. I was kind of anticipating another at least few weeks or months until I had like deep out of the money covered calls on everything. That was my plan. But then we kind of crashed before I could get too many of those. But, you know, I think selling deep out of the money covered calls as you're at new record highs is not a bad idea for, you know, investing in general. But, you know, if you have one of those generational stocks about to go, you know, crazy like Tesla did last year, then you're going to be out of luck big time if you sell an out of the money covered call on that. But in general, it's a strategy some people employ, I think, on overall just stocks in general that aren't like an anomaly like Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the possibilities do you think? Like, okay, so we dropped, let's say, with Tesla 25%. There's a bunch of other growth stocks similar. How do you view like the possibilities of it bouncing relatively quick back to all-time highs, let's say in the next few months, versus it takes a couple years to go back to all-time highs? What are your thinking or your thoughts on that?
I think it's really 50-50, to be honest. I mean, you have a new administration, you know, a new, you know, Janet Yellen, you know, taking the reins again, you know, and interest rates coming back, you know, could be a new 4 years here of interest rates coming back to, you know, 2 to 4% or something like that, that could really reset valuations to be lower and discourage investing in growth stocks, you know. But I think there's going to be some outliers that really outperform that are going to justify very fast rising prices, stock prices, you know. But overall, all the growth stocks, you know, I think in general, it's going to, you know, they could be years before they get to all-time highs. That's like on one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is this is not really a big deal. These interest rates at 1.5%, you know, 10-year rates, and maybe goes up even to 2% or something. And then we kind of the stock market's back off to the races from there again, you know? So those are the two scenarios I see playing out, but which one it is, I honestly have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does hurt to see like, oh, you know, my portfolio was at a certain point and then to see it drop. But then on another hand, I look at it kind of like, there's times of consolidation that a stock goes through, and it doesn't mean that it's like disjointed. It can be disassociated from the company's actual execution and performance. Like Tesla is just going to do their thing, you know. Great growth companies are going to do their thing, and the stock might not, you know, look like what the company's really, you know, how they're really doing. And so there could be, you know, like we saw with Tesla back in what, 2014 to 2019, just 5 years of consolidation. Yeah. So, you know, we had a big run up. So, you know, I think a possibility is a consolidation period, you know, and what that looks like, it could be pretty volatile, you know, during that time.
Yeah. The whole market could be consolidating for a few years. Yeah.
That's true too. Yeah. Cause you know, the market just, especially the NASDAQ, what at like 13,000 right now.
Yeah.
So there's different possibilities, or it could, you know, I mean, with all the stimulus coming in, money printing, you have a lot of money chasing assets and stuff. And so you still have like overall though, it's for me, I look at it kind of longer term picture. I go, hey, if I'm to bet one side, I'm going to bet on being long, you know, I'm going to bet on the market. I mean, you've got all of the right conditions, you know, where else are you going to put your money, you know, for gains? It's not just, you know, in the stock market, but if you can pick the best companies, the best of the best, I still think like that's probably one of the best kind of ways to go about it long term.
Yeah. I mean, historically the market goes up 6% a year, you know, and I think over time it's going to be higher than that, as technology helps, you know, companies leverage technology more and more to increase revenues faster than they have in the past. So yeah, I think going long, you're kind of at an advantage long term, but from year to year, for every 5 year period, it's hard to really know for sure.
Yeah. This past week, I did a couple interviews with James Dalma on kind of Tesla's full self-driving. And it just really, as the more I get into Tesla's full self-driving, their autonomous driving, like AI, and it's the more I just get like very convinced or very confident of Tesla's position right now, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. I still think they're very, you know, they're valued in a sense very enthusiastically by the market still. But I mean, considering what can happen over the next few to several years with robotaxi and autonomous driving, I don't think people are fully grasping the magnitude of change that's going to happen, you know, with AI driving. It's basically AI taking over your driving experience, you know. It's moving from a dumb car to a smart car that's going to be driving you, chauffeuring you around. It's like it's a robot chauffeur, you know. That concept, I think people don't completely grasp how big of a market that is, and how the big winner in that field is going to accrue possibly trillions of dollars of value. I think like before, like probably just even about four or five months ago, I was thinking, you know, maybe Tesla will be ahead, of course, and will be first place, but there will be these, you know, second and third place people on their heels, maybe a few years after, right? And nowadays I'm thinking, I kind of think there's a chance that Tesla could have a winner take most kind of effect on the autonomous driving market, because in some ways, I think it's going to be easy to get to 99.9% safety with autonomous cars. I think it's going to be a solved problem. A lot of these competitors are going to get there. But what the angle of Tesla is they're trying to get the 99.9999, keep on going till it's like as perfect as it can be. And I'm starting to think that perhaps that those extra nines, like anything matters a lot because it's dealing with life and death, you know?
Yeah, and each nine is huge.
Yeah, and I'm thinking perhaps that might be Tesla's competitive advantage going forward with autonomous driving. Combine that with the safety of their cars, the efficiency of their cars, the brand, you know, the experience, the whole ecosystem and all of that. It just seems like, it's the next 10 years is going to be amazing for Tesla. And that's just something, you know, this past week as the market's just going crazy, that I'm just zoning in kind of on. And, you know, talking with James Dalmo with AI and full self-driving, it's just, it's a cool kind of, it was a cool respite to just kind of, you know, hey, this is all crazy, but you know, what matters over the next 10 years, you know?
Yeah. It's a major call option in the stock, you know, in the company. It's like people are investing and valuing it on everything but that right now, it feels like. And it's like the biggest elephant in the room that analysts don't really value, you know? And I agree, that's like an information advantage right there. It's just a matter of when, hopefully, right? I mean, I'm not 99% sure that Tesla's gonna do it successfully, but I'm maybe 75 to 80% sure, right? So it's like, I'm pretty confident that they're gonna do this successfully. Mm-hmm. Just a matter of when. Will they release it, you know, to the masses end of this year, sometime this year? Will it be 2 or 3 years from now until they're comfortable with enough nines of confidence to, you know? So that's the matter. That's the only thing I'm not certain about. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the nines matter a lot in their how safe they are. Like another company might be 99.99%, but Tesla, if they're an extra 1 9, that's 1/10 the amount of incidents. Or if they're 2 9s, it's 1/100 the amount of incidents as the next best thing. And so when this, you know, when you see reports of accidents from, you know, self-driving cars, and you see that Tesla is not, you know, statistically close to anyone else, like they're so much safer, you know, everyone's going to flock to buying the Teslas, right? Like you said, the winner takes up most, you know? So even if others claim, whether it's Waymo or, you know, Cruise or Mobileye, you know, if they claim that, you know, it's really the matter of the nines, like how safe really it is. And that'll statistically show itself in pretty short order. So, you know, I agree with you 100%. It's really fascinating, this extra, you know, business that's about to, you know, we don't even know the full potential of it. It's just like, it's incredible. There's so much creative ideas and industry that'll be created from this. It's going to be fascinating to watch. I even thought about putting down deposits on some semi trucks because I think there's going to be a massive, you know, opportunity there. I just don't fully understand it, you know, yet. But, you know, one of my cousins worked in like logistics for like trucking, and I'm talking to him about ideas. And anyway, it's just, there's lots of opportunities with autonomous driving, you know, assuming Tesla gets there way ahead of time.
Yeah.
Before everyone else.
Yeah. I'm like super confident with Tesla's where they're at right now. I just think they're just nailing it. Everything they're doing is just right on spot. And I think it's just solvable problems just ahead, where, you know, they're just making it more reliable, fixing stuff. But they've got the full architecture. They've got the full machine going. It's like, we're so close. Like Tesla is really so close to nailing this problem. It's crazy.
Yeah. I listened to 1.5 of your James Duma chats. Mm-hmm. You released the last two quickly.
That's true. Yeah. It was like right
so
after. Yeah.
The last one, I'm like, all right, I got to finish this one before I get to the last one. So I was hoping to get caught up, but today just family stuff kept me busy. But I listened to half of the second one, the bird's eye one. You know, interesting, the bird's eye view and stuff that he talks about. He seems really knowledgeable in this stuff. So it's a good person to be chatting with, I think.
Yeah, the second one is good too. He talks about how Tesla is kind of imitating LiDAR or figuring out depth of objects through, like, he's basically doing what LiDAR is doing, but through imaging, which is crazy. So we have a Twitter follower says, Snowball, he says, He was asking about the macro environment, inflation expectations, 10-year treasury yields, expected growth, and your thoughts on asset allocation for the next couple of years. For example, stocks, real estate, crazy bets, defensive bets, cash, et cetera. Do you have any thoughts kind of on the macro environment or on kind of how you view asset allocation over the next few years?
Yeah, I've been thinking more and more about real estate just from a personal point of view as like a good, solid diversification play. But I don't know if I'm really going to do it, but I think that's a solid play, especially in not cities. I wouldn't get into real estate in cities, but like, you know, I think real estate in suburbs of cities are just nice areas to live. I think with things like self-driving cars, like we've been talking about, and Zoom to work from home, I think living in cities and commuting to cities is going to be much less, you know, convenient for people. And that's my thought. And I've been thinking that for a few years, but I think even more so, real estate seems like it's got some room to catch up to valuations that, you know, stocks and other things have kind of gone up recently, but real estate's going to come up pretty soon. What about you? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always bullish on kind of companies because I feel like, you know, the execution on by these kind of outlier amazing entrepreneurs mm-hmm. can really get rewarded in a company, especially with technology, right? So yeah, my eyes are open with not just normal stocks, but I want to find those stocks that are just that are in the right place, the right time, with the right entrepreneur, using the right technology in a fast-growing industry. And so, yeah, I think those are, you know, kind of timeless because the next 10 years with AI is just going to be insane how fast and how much, you know, it impacts. Yeah, real estate, I'm bullish on for the next 10 years, generally speaking. I think there are areas where I'm not as bullish, but, you know, suburbs of desirable suburbs in main, you know, hubs are I think there's been a massive shortage. So I was reading today, the past decade, it was kind of one of the, in terms of construction of new houses, was one of the lowest kind of decades in a very, very long time. And I've seen this in many different reports, et cetera, but they just didn't build enough. And partly it was because after the Great Recession, all these builders were scared. And there's a lot of just slow building. And so you have this massive appetite for housing, but there just isn't enough supply. And so mm-hmm. we're kind of stuck right now. And this is what's happening right now. And almost all of the most desirable suburbs, there just isn't supply anymore. And prices are just skyrocketing. Real estate is interesting. It's just, I'm always open. I would love to do something actually that I could leverage in a safe way, but it doesn't require maintenance, you know, yeah. Meaning
all that extra work or paperwork that you have to do.
Exactly. I don't want to buy single family houses. I don't want to buy small apartment buildings. And of course, it all
depends.
What about
real estate investment trusts? What about like a well? That's what I'm thinking about, like exchange-traded real estate investment trusts.
I mean, I was actually going through a bunch of them a couple months ago. And let me know if you find anything or any viewers, et cetera. But okay. I'm looking for something that's kind of more like exponential a little bit, like mm-hmm. that can give like some really good growth in yields, you know? And
yeah.
So for example, like, you know, can we get 20-25% a year, you know, and on these REITs, like you're not going to find that probably, you know, most likely. So that leads my attention to like other places. Like, is there opportunity buying land, let's say outskirts of Austin or something, or are the opportunities in somehow building like an apartment complex, like in a suburb with, you know, a few hundred units, but that's professionally managed, but then I don't want to build it. You know, I don't want to get in, I don't want to be, you know, myself, the point person. And so, all in a lot of it also depends on just, you know, the risk reward factor, you know, how much of an upside, right, does that project have and compared to the risk. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing. I'm also looking into kind of the private secondary markets of to stocks of companies as well. And I'm finding it like, I'm having mixed experiences with it. There's not a lot of transparency in this world of kind of secondary markets. So yeah, it's kind of, it's more of a learning experience for me. But yeah, interesting stuff though. I'm curious, during the past few weeks, how have you personally been handling the volatility? I know, you know, you've started this fund and now you have some investors come in, so you're not just managing your own money. Does that make it more stressful for you at all? Like seeing kind
it
of,
does. It does make it more stressful. I mean, it brings it back to the stress levels of, you know, a year ago where I was kind of managing my own money, but it was like, okay, I'm close to making enough money where I can walk away from my job and do what I want. Or if the market goes down, you know, if I lose a lot of this, then I guess I'm stuck working at my job for another 10 or 20 years. Not that I like my job, but it was like my, you know, it's nice to have the option to be able to walk away and have that FU money or whatever, you know? So I was like stressful in that way. And now it's stressful. Like now I have that. And even though the market's going down, like I have enough, but it's stressful because, you know, some investors have entrusted me with investment capital of theirs, and I treat it very seriously now, you know, or I always have treated it seriously, but now I'm like, it's like extra pressure, but I'm trying not to let that affect my decision-making of my investment philosophy, if that makes sense. You know, the investment philosophy that's sort of like gotten me here, you know, my investment philosophy is to not be static and do the same thing over and over because the market's always changing. Right. And so I'm just trying to adapt to the markets the best way I can. And, you know, it doesn't, I'm not going to keep buying out of the money Tesla calls, for example, because I don't think that's, I haven't been doing that because I don't think that's a profitable game to play in the markets for a while now, you know, since the S&P inclusion. So I'm doing other things though. And I'm trying to, you know, do it as if I didn't have investor capital, but it was like a pool of money I'm working on my investment philosophy with, you know, but at the same time, I know there's investor capital in it, and it makes it more stressful because I really don't want to lose their money, but I make it very clear when they're investing, like it's a very high risk. You know, I turn down a ton of investors because there's like some, you know, it's high risk and you have to meet certain liquidity requirements to even invest in my fund. And so I don't want to lose people's like a meaningful portion of someone's savings if I fail, you know? And so that helps me a little bit, but you know, it is stressful. Yeah, it is. But yeah. I try not to let it affect my decision making. And I think of the bigger picture in mind is like, okay, is it worth, should I just return everyone's? No, my bigger picture is like, I want this to be successful so that I can, you know, make a name for giving back as part of the fee structure to hedge funds and investment managers, and others might follow suit, you know. And I think a future of investment managers giving, you know, 25% of their fees or 20% or 10%, you know, all different, whatever they decide, but putting in their prospectuses, we're giving, you know, 20% of our fees that we collect to charity or something, whatever it is, I'm giving half, but whatever they want, as long, if that becomes like a trend, like ESG investing in a way now, I think that could really change the course of history for our society, you know, in terms of the likelihood of us going into socialism or not, for example.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, let's say before your fund last year, let's say during some stressful times, were you able to just, for example, to shut things down for a few days or a week or two, just like not really keep up with media, the financial news, the stock prices too much, and just kind of like step back at all? And
I was not. No,
you were just really glued in it as well.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Really glued. Like, you know, I could take off like half a day maybe and do stuff with the family for on the weekend, like a Saturday or Sunday when the markets are closed. But come Sunday evening when the futures are getting ready to open, I'm like, where is the futures going to open? Are we going to be down 3%? Is it going to be up 2% by the morning? What's going to happen? You know? And
yeah,
I just needed to know. I was losing sleep and I'd be waking up in the middle of the night sometimes checking, you know, and you hear stories of hedge fund managers doing that type of thing, you know, and I was experiencing, even though I wasn't a hedge fund manager, I felt like I'm checking the international markets at night, or waking up at 4 a.m. because I can't go back to sleep. And, you know,
I mean, do you feel like now though you're having to intake more broader information, like you're having to follow more companies and you're having to keep up with more of the financial news cycle, whereas before maybe you could be more focused or concentrated. And does that add to kind of the load you feel, to kind of the responsibility?
A little bit. Yeah, there's like a number of names. I'm trying to keep it to a basket of, you know, no more than 10 or so, you know, names to track and follow. And instead of like before, it was like really one or two, like Tesla and Interactive Broker, you know, my company I worked for. But the global macro market was the big story, you know, a year ago, you know, and the coronavirus, like what's really going on with this coronavirus and such. And now, like, you know, the stress is the global macro market again, you know, it's not the individual names so much, you know, because the one thing is if you have, you know, 10 names, you know, and there's some terrible news on one or something's happening to one name, you know, it's not like your whole portfolio that's going down and you have to, you know, you want to be on top of it, but it's, you know, it's not as stressful in a way, you know, diversifying a little bit too, you know?
Yeah. How often are you having to update the investors who've invested in your fund?
Yeah. So they get a I'm sending out a quarterly letter to them of like updated weightings of the positions and performance for the quarter and such. And then they're also getting a monthly update on their net asset value of their investment in the fund. So the first calendar day of the month. So the first investors came in on February 1st and more have come in March 1st and so forth. So every first day of calendar month, I think they're all receiving kind of an update on their net asset value.
I see. Got it.
Their investment.
Got it.
From the administrator of the fund.
Yeah. Do you have any tips or things that you try to do to reduce your stress at all, to kind of get bigger picture, make some clear decisions?
Yeah, I take a lot of walks. You know, I like to listen to research, you know, like podcasts of, you know, analysts that I respect greatly and get their ideas and pictures on things. For example, you know, investor presentations, but I like to go for walks, for example, when I'm doing that, or exercise a lot, you know, some days, you know, I make sure I don't exercise every day, but I try to make sure a few times a week I'm getting a good workout in and, you know, keep my stress levels low. And I get to bed early, make sure I try to get like 8 or 9 hours of sleep if possible, which is not likely, but you know, some days I do get that much and it's helpful. Yeah. I mean, all those things. And I try to, you know, eat well, just keep my physical health as strong as I can. And that helps reduce my stress level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Let's go to a couple more viewer or follower questions. So Kevin says, what's your thoughts on Roblox's direct listing in early March? I think it's March 10th. They're being listed on the New York Stock Exchange. After their last round of funding, will they be too richly valued? I think they raised money at a $30 billion market cap valuation. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Roblox? Has it changed at all?
Yeah, they just had their investor presentation day. I think it was Friday. I listened to it. I watched it live. And then their Q&A discussion I listened to later on that day. And I was very impressed. I mean, it's basically what I expected. The only concern I have, you know, there's two concerns I have. One is, what's their valuation going to be, you know, when they start trading? You know, there's a lot of people interested in this. And I guess it depends on the macro market. If the macro markets are still kind of volatile and, you know, it might be low, it might be more opportunistic to get in actually. But I think they raised capital $30 billion. If they start trading on day one at $50 billion or more, that's like, that's a little high. It's pretty high, you know? But if they start trading at $25 billion or $35 billion, you know, I'm like, oh, that's pretty attractive to me. The other concern I have is the management team, you know, like the people that were all speaking, you know, when they do it on the Zoom, on the YouTube, I got to see them all and they're all like in their 50s and 60s, it feels like. I was like, where's the young people? You know, like, can't they have like one or two young people on their management team, someone under like 40 or something? Like, I'm like, man, And I was a little concerned, you know. Hopefully they're directors and B-level, you know, they have 1,000 employees now or something. So hopefully there's quite a bit of young people like making decisions there. Not to say that old people can't think young, but, you know, it's like, it just concerned me a little bit, you know. But overall, I think they have a potential for an enormous future if executed well, you know, but if executed well is the key. And there's so many factors and variables they have to play well in order to kind of stay ahead of the game with attracting developers, making sure they're number one, you know, a top spot for developers to go and create content. That's what it's about. They want to create that viral loop of attracting the best developers to make the best content, which brings more users, and then those users tell their friends, and it just creates this viral loop, you know. And so if they can execute that well, that would be incredible, but it's just a matter of execution. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you watch your investor day or hear anything about that?
Yeah. I watched their investor day and their Q&A earlier today on like 2x speed. I can't stand watching stuff at 1x speed. Just like,
I know. I tune out so much during the 1x speed. So yeah, slow. Yeah. I should put on 2x speed. Yeah.
I've watched several of their presentations, and you know what I like about them, I think one of their key insights is the trust and safety element, where they really like believe more strongly than other kind of metaverses out there and social networks. They believe in like that they need to set the rules and they need to make it as safe as they can make it. And that's step one. That's the foundation of everything. The second thing is what I like about them is they're really riding on the coattails of changing technology that's much bigger than them, meaning you have the whole wave of GPUs and, you know, metaverses will get increasingly more higher in fidelity. So they're going to become more and more real life, not because of just Roblox. It's going to happen because of the technology out there, you know? And Roblox is just kind of riding that wave of metaverses becoming more high fidelity. And the way they're writing it is they're saying, we're going to provide the safest, kind of most trusted environment for people to come and interact. And then we're going to treat our developers super well and try to get them to be successful on this platform. And they have a lot of the right priorities, I think, that really, I think, make it a very attractive long-term business. I do agree on valuation. I mean, this is the tricky part. I was looking at Unity valuation because I think they're a good comp, and I think investors will kind of compare them. So Unity, they IPO'd, I think, $20 billion. They went up to $40 billion market cap, and I think they're down to $30 billion right now. Yeah. And so I would imagine investors give, you know, Roblox something around there, like 30, if not slightly lower. I would be surprised if it's much higher than 30, actually. If it's like 40, I would be actually pretty surprised. But we'll see, you know, if it debuts, you know, around, you know, 25 or something, that would be decent, I think.
Yeah. I hope so. I wouldn't be surprised if they debut at 50 or 60 billion, to be honest, just because it's been talked about so much and so many retail, you know, people interested in it, that they're not giving, I don't know, how much stock are they offering right now? It's not like a whole ton, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. We'll see. I hope it's not like that. I hope it's closer to 30 or 35 billion.
Yeah. Do your kids play Roblox at all?
Oh yeah, they do. Yeah. I've played it with them a number of times. Mm-hmm. They like Minecraft a lot. It keeps going back and forth between which one they prefer more, Minecraft or Roblox, but they play them both and they love them. We limit them to like 2 hours a day and just on weekends, and which is includes Friday. But yeah, we try to limit it. It's like that Roblox and Minecraft is like kid crack in a way. It's like scary. You know, they'll be out for the day, like doing fun things, and they'll be like, what time is it? And we're like, they never ask what time it is, but now they ask what time it is because they want to make sure they're home by, you know, 3 o'clock when they're allowed to do the Roblox from 3 to 5.
Yeah.
It's like, really, it's creepy.
Yeah,
how,
no,
it's how in tune they are and around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I'm not really introducing my 6-year-old to video games.
Yeah,
there's certain personalities like that really like get really into it. Some kids, you know, and My 6-year-old is one of those personality types.
It's scary. I mean, yeah. I don't know. My kids are like that too. It's like, I don't know. As long as we can limit it carefully, I feel like we can't. For us, you know, our kids are going to like a, you know, a school with other kids that are doing it and all this. Yeah. And it's like we can either try to run away from it or try to embrace the technology that they're doing with their friends and control it in a healthy way if possible.
It's true.
But it's hard. It tears me. Yeah. You know, up inside a little bit.
Yeah, we're doing these things where we let our kids kind of play with like the music app or our own photo app or, you know, messaging app or something for, you know, 5-10 minutes at a time, a few times a day. But it's like, it's not enough for my 6-year-old because he's like, if he would have it his way, he would be on it all day or something, right?
Even just something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But what's funny is we had this, he found this like stencil kit that, that we had, when we were designing iPhone apps. You have like these stencil kits where you have like, you can design like icons or different navigation items for iPhone apps or something. He found this, and then the past 2 weeks he's been like designing his own apps like on these pieces of paper, and they're like complex stuff, and like they're like back and forth, like all covered with different, and they're not like professional. Wow. Like, you know, they're like, but they're like intense. They're like 100 different functions in one phone screen or something. He's making this up. Yeah. But part of it is because I think he's like, his mind is racing, you know, like just playing with, you know, the technology. It's like so fascinating.
He's very curious.
He just turned 6 years old too. And it's like insane. Another question from Jasco M says, hi Dave, I'd like yours and Emmett's opinion on Lucid and the future outlook of the company.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about Lucid. I have a friend who I've met recently who was very interested in them, very, you know, into them. I think they're going to be like the second place to Tesla. And he seems to have researched it a lot, but me, from what I know, I just don't think they have what it takes to do much. You know, like I think Fisker would be number two to Tesla outside of China, maybe. You know, they already signed a deal with that Magna, you know, car manufacturer in Europe. But, and the Henrik Fisker, just like his third time around, I guess the first was with Tesla, second was when he did the Karma, which failed. Now you'd think his third time around he'd learn something, and if he's halfway competent, can put it together a little more manageably, you know. You know, that could be a distant second place still to me. I think Lucid at the, I guess it's like $40 billion valuation, $30 billion. I don't, what's the valuation lately? I don't even know. It's going up and down like crazy, yeah, right? No, do you know what it is, Dave?
No, it's like, what, man, the stock price has been crazy. It got what, cut in half the other day?
Yeah.
Right now it's,
I think it's just insane. Yeah, the valuation on this. I mean, they haven't even produced, I saw their projections from their SPAC, right? And it says they're going to produce like 100,000 cars in 2024 or 2023, and that's going to be $10 billion of revenue. Yeah. So they're selling like, they think they're going to sell $100,000 luxury cars. Like, what? That's insane to me. Like, I don't buy that. I don't even think they can produce that many even if they demand for it. Like, that's, you know, I don't even think they'll have demand for that, to be honest. Like, I don't want to touch that thing, to be honest. The only potential saving grace is I think Johnny Ive from Apple is somehow involved with designing their cars. I don't know if he's on the board or somehow. I don't think he's on the board. I think he's just like involved somehow. Yeah, in designing in their car. And I know Apple, right? That seems like a natural partner for them potentially. Maybe they'd take a stake in Lucid, you know, similar to how Amazon took a stake in Rivian. Who knows? But that's the saving grace to see for Lucid is if Apple kind of jumped in to help them out, boost them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, so disclosure, I have a tiny speculative position on CCIV from long time ago, like sub 20, you know, but, Yeah, my whole thing is I think there's an appeal to that company because I think they really do have some engineering expertise there that can be pretty valuable to legacy OEMs or to some new entrants like Apple. The problem, though, is with this inflated market cap, it becomes a more difficult acquisition target. So, yeah. You know, if it was like $2 or $3 billion in market cap, Apple could just sweep in and, you know, pick them up and and take over
for $5 billion plans. Or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. You know, pay a premium. But so anyways, yeah, I think Lucid sticks around in some form, maybe merges with another company eventually or something. But I think,
you know, they'll do something like that.
Yeah, they have IP. They've got some engineering talent. I think, yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I'm not.
I mean, just think about it. 2 years ago, Tesla was like a $30 or $40 billion market cap company, right? And they were still producing a lot of cars. And they had Elon Musk and that whole engineering team, you know, and the factories. And
exactly.
Here Lucid is. It's like QuantumScape, but the EV version of QuantumScape.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of these EV stocks that I scratch my head, you know, where, you know, they're billions of dollars of market cap, but do they really have like much of a product? You know, are they really?
So many of these SPACs like coming out of like, you know, that are at these crazy valuations, but they don't even have anything being produced yet. But the markets are giving or paying up for some of this stuff. I think there's a big bubble in the SPAC universe right now.
Yeah. I'm tempted to buy puts on some of these EV stocks. Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah.
Let's say Anthony says, what is it like being retired and working on your own time? Question for you both. And then a serious question, though, is we are all pursuing more wealth, many for financial freedom. Once there, how should we be thinking about it leading up? To qualify this, you're not retired, right? I mean, you're working.
No. I have, but yeah, there is that time where you like, you have enough, like I was talking about earlier, like, you know, I was on the fringe of like, do I have enough money to retire if I want to and do whatever I want? Or do I have to keep working for another 10 years or 20 years, you know? And that was what I was stressed out about a year ago when the markets were volatile. Right. And then things went my way and there's like it's like an identity crisis almost, right? It's like when you get to that point, you know, the destination, it's like, okay, I'm at that, the journey's over. I'm at the destination. Now what? You know, you got to come up with a new journey for yourself, you know? And you don't want to come up with just a new destination, but you want to come up with a journey that's fun, you know, too. You know, a destination and a journey that's fun. In your next career choice or what you're going to do with your life next, you know? And that's the tricky part. It's like an identity crisis is the way I think of it. You really have to be careful. You hear a lot of stories of people, you know, especially people that like win the lottery, you know, they're like, that's some of the people that have the worst things happen to them after they win the lottery, because it's like this crisis of like, okay, I have all this money, I'm retiring, I'm going to play golf every day, you know, or whatever. I'm going to move to a big house and just not work and watch Netflix all day or something, you know, like you got to have some mission or purpose. It's tricky. You got to really dig deep and everyone's different, you know? Works for me.
How important, like how much were you looking forward to, or how big of a goal was it for you to reach this point of so-called financial freedom or this place where you can do whatever you want? You didn't have to work for anybody. Like, was this something that you were hoping for? You're looking forward to? Was it a priority? Like, how did you think about all that?
Yeah. You know, it was always in the back of my head with the Tesla for years. I was like, man, this Tesla is going to be huge. I thought it would be like 5 years from now, not like this year, you know? But it was always in the back of my head, like I'll make enough with my Tesla stock eventually where I don't have to work and then I can figure out what to do. And so I'd been thinking about what I'm going to do, but I jumped from like, you know, a couple million to like 100 million or whatever in like a year, you know, that's a crazy jump. I thought I would be like 5 or 10 and I'd be like, okay, I'm pretty much set for life. And now I can start a business where I could be like, you know, depend on the business and still have to work hard. But now it's like, starting a business just to make more money isn't attractive to me, you know? And so I need to find something deeper, more purposeful to do. And so that's where I kind of struggled. It was like two levels more than I was ready for, you know, of wealth change in a quick period of time. So it was good. But it was also, you know, it made me think about life differently, a lot. And it was also during the coronavirus crash when at the time we didn't really know how serious this thing was. Is it killing, you know, half the people or 10% of the people infected or 4% even, you know, or we didn't really know how serious this thing was for a while too. So it was like a scary time a year ago, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers the question. Does that answer? Was there another part of the question?
Yeah. No, it was like, what is it like being retired or working on your own time? So I guess, you know, that.
And you have your YouTube thing. You're bringing a huge amount of information to the masses. You know, you have an incredible mission you've come up with, right? I mean, what do you think about it?
Yeah. I mean, in my situation, it was a combination of kind of early on of having kind of low living expenses. And combining that with having some passive income from real estate where it was covering our living expenses, where kind of early on we reached the point where like we didn't need to work and we would be fine. And so Tesla became something, it was more like something we could, if it worked out, it's bonus. And if it works out, it's not just bonus, but if it works out, it's like I wanted it to work out and I felt confident it would, but it was more for the concept of growing resources so that we could do more with this in the world. We can make an impact. And so, yeah, it's kind of, I think maybe in some ways, I think our perspective hasn't really changed that much over, you know.
It was much more gradual for you.
Yeah, because that was really early on. And then and we decided to still keep our software business and run that on the side. And we were kind of more full-time like parenting as well. With my YouTube channel more recently, this was actually more of a like this personal mission to leave something behind for my kids and anyone else. And so, but I think, it's always been something, a super high priority to do what I want to do with my life. And the thing is, I realized that and I lived that way before I had even enough money to do that. Meaning, like, even when I was, like, living off of, like, you know, less than $2,000 a month or something, right? In my 20s and early 30s, like, I was still doing what I wanted to do. Like I just felt like, I don't know, early on, I never felt like I never had it in myself to just feel unhappy with the workout that I'm doing. You know, I'd rather take a big, you know, financial hit or just live poorly to do what I want to do, you know? But that's kind of just like my own personal journey. And I think because of that, whatever resources kind of go up, you know, whatever amount, it doesn't have as much impact because I've kind of, since my early 20s, I've been doing what I've been wanting to do and I still do what I want to do. But, you know, there is this aspect where there is a bit more stability and more resources to do more things, you know? But yeah, definitely.
It's a good perspective. I mean, you have a different kind of upbringing and background that kind of helped you, have that discipline, I think, or ability to kind of stick with what you want to do, you know, even if your income was much less, you know, so that's good. And it's worked out very well, you know, so that's great.
Yeah. I've always had kind of this rebellious thing. I'm okay with like doing something that no one does as long as I think, you know, it makes sense to me. Another, follower says, Junopolis says, when the iPhone and iPad was launched, sometimes it was even better to buy shares in the suppliers and component manufacturers like CRUS or SWKS. Now with chip shortages for cars, wouldn't it be also a good investment to buy shares in companies in the supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, that's on my list to figure out the best suppliers. People talk about like the mining companies that Tesla works with, and other suppliers, but that's not something I've been able to dig deep enough into myself. But I'd love for any, maybe we should put something out on Twitter or something, or comments of your YouTube channel. Anyone who's got some ideas on the best suppliers that kind of are good pure play suppliers of Tesla even, or EVs. I know there's like MP, that SPAC that Chamath put out, rare earth materials, that's big for batteries and stuff. But that's, so that's a whole realm I'd like to get into, that are, it seems like there's a lot of opportunities there. That's my thoughts. Do you have any thoughts, Dave?
I think the iPhone, so I have different angles on this. I think with the iPhone and iPad, you had some suppliers that were going to take advantage, not just of Apple and, their relationship, but they're going to take advantage of the entire kind of smartphone revolution, but not just smartphones, but the Internet of Things and just sensors and just, the proliferation of electronics, et cetera. And so certain suppliers could ride that wave and be much big, like Apple is part of that. My concern with Tesla suppliers is a lot of the car itself is kind of old school technology. It's not the next generation of electronics and, waves and billions of phones and whatever, it's certain like windshield wipers and brakes and whatever, calipers or things that, it's not really innovative or revolutionary in some ways that they're going to be able to 10x, 100x their market, with the trend of technology. And so in that sense, I have a little bit where I'm like, I think it's a little bit different. Some of the suppliers, yes, they could grow just off of the coattails of Tesla. But another risk factor with these suppliers is Tesla can just make their own parts. And they've done that in the past. They had a seat supplier, but now they make their own seats. That seat supplier is gone, like out of their, they don't have a
I
relationship,
remember
right?
that.
Yeah. And so no part is off limits for Tesla. And Tesla will cut, their suppliers if they can make it cheaper and better. I think perhaps one of the most interesting areas is the battery supply chain, because this is something that if you're a supplier, play a key role, you can supply not just Tesla, but you can supply the entire industry. But this is an industry that will be growing rapidly over the next 20 years. Like we have, decades of growth in this. This is like the battery part. That's what I'm talking about, Like if you can find the right suppliers in that, that's going to be interesting. And if you can do some call options on the good ones.
I've been looking at that Chamath spec for a while. It's gone up a lot recently, but I wish I bought some. But I think, the MP one or whatever. But yeah, batteries, that's a big one, supply chain. And didn't Tesla just change, say they're, wasn't there a report that says that now they're not going with nickel, they're going to use like more, what, iron phosphate or something instead of nickel for their batteries? Yeah, so it's changing too. It's like you got to keep up with that and know which, Tesla's going to be leading. I feel like, they're the biggest producer or manufacturer of batteries in the world, and they probably will be for, the next several years, right? So you got to kind of keep up with how they're changing things, and what suppliers it affects, I guess, too.
I think there's different angles to look at it. One, you have like the commodity suppliers, basically the nickel and the lithium and the different, parts that will go into the batteries. But then you have certain companies that actually provide technologies, whether it's the anode or cathode or different, machines or parts of that. That is more interesting to me a little bit. And then you have also some more kind of battery plays. I'm looking a little bit into CATL, CATL, based in China. I think the sense I'm getting is Tesla really respects them. I think Tesla is, from their what they've signed with CATL, like in terms of agreements, it seems like they are the next biggest battery player in the world. Like above Panasonic, et cetera. They've got some crazy growth plans right now. They're just spending billions of dollars making new factories. They can't make enough of them. They're just, and they seem to have the technology to back it up. And so, yeah, I mean, their stock has been hit a bit. I think it's down 20% in the past couple of weeks. I'd love to see it go down more. But yeah, it's definitely, yeah, but, and then there are some like more spec plays on like, yeah, I'm going to have some guy on my channel, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. I did a spec investment on this one tiny kind of company. I don't want to pump it up in any, everyone has to make their own decisions. So I don't want to even want to, you know, say that it's a good investment, but it was a small spec play, but it's, yeah, there are some interesting companies that are trying to vie for spaces in, you know, some space in the battery supply chain. And I think there will be some big winners, you know, some big 10Xers or 100Xers. And, you know, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Next question, John says, what are the most impactful ways that people can improve their lives right now? What are the best ways to escape a mental rut? Thank you.
For me, I think, physical health is key, you know, and that's like sleep, getting the right amount of sleep. I got this thing from my bed called the Chili Pad. Chili Technology makes it, whatever, or an Uller Pad or something like that. And so basically, it cools the mattress that I sleep on all night long. You put it underneath your mattress cover. It's like this thing that has like water veins running through it. So you don't really notice it's there, but it's just keeping it cool the whole night. Because normally throughout the night, like when you sleep, when you sit on a mattress, and at first it feels cool, but like an hour or two into the night, it gets warm because your body heat heats up the mattress and that body heat comes back to you, you know? So this is kind of like simulating like, you know, pre-beds when we used to sleep on the earth, you know, like when you go camping, you get good sleep sometimes because you're sleeping on the earth, which stays cool the whole night, you know? But, and so this kind of keeps you cool the whole night. And it's supposedly, and it, for me, it makes a difference. I measure it with an Oura ring. I actually lost my Oura ring ordering a new one, which is a ring that measures your sleep with a smartphone app. And it records how much deep sleep versus REM sleep I get. So I keep track of my sleep. And I noticed when I got this Uller pad or Chili Technology pad that my sleep got like at least 10 or 20% better every night for the same amount of time sleeping. Like I was waking up less throughout the night. I had more deep sleep and more REM sleep throughout the night. And I just felt more refreshed. And it's the simplest thing for me to like improve my sleep is just get that and then press a button every night, or you can hook it up to your smartphone to automatically do it. I don't have to do anything. I'm just improving my sleep, you know? And so sleep is for me, number one, number two, you know, and three is diet and exercise. And some people go crazy with exercise. I don't think it's necessary to go overboard. I've been in periods of my life where I exercise like ridiculous amounts every day for, you know, for a long time. And now I'm kind of at a phase where I just try to get like, you know, two or three good workouts a week. And then every other day I try to go for a walk or something, you know, a long walk or a short walk even, but I try to get outside. Sunlight is important, I think. But then the diet is also key for me. And, you know, that's a whole nother thing, the diet. We can go on forever about that and at some other point, but lots of people have different ideas on diet. I try to think like, okay, our ancestors evolved a certain way to eat a certain way. That's how our bodies are meant to, are designed to take in nutrients and food. And so I try to mimic that a little bit. Sort of like the paleo diet, I guess, but it's a little more low carb, less vegetables than even the paleo diet. So anyway, that's my tips for improving stress. Also, people do meditation or breathing exercises. You know, there's lots of things that can take cold showers. That helps sometimes. So I do a lot of different things, I guess. Do you have any idea? You have any? I know you have some interesting things you do, right, Dave?
Yeah. Talk about it. I always have different things I'm trying to. But one of the things I did in my 20s that was really helpful, I was living in LA City, like in kind of the smack center. And I was living actually right on Crenshaw Boulevard, which is one of the main arteries in the city. And I remember it was just like sometimes you just couldn't go anywhere or do anything because just you couldn't get out of that just box, you know, of stress. Mm-hmm. And often I would, you know, just go out to the beach and I would, you know, drive out to Santa Monica and rollerblade for like an hour or two. And instantly, you know, all my stress would just be like gone for that moment. And I could kind of think from a little bit of a different angle, like seeing the ocean. And then another thing I was doing was, which I would head out to the beach, and then there was this fantastic hotel that was like, you know, ridiculously priced on the ocean, like on the beach. And like what I would do is I would go and at nighttime, during the weekdays, I would go and I just order like tea and maybe like a piece of pie or something. It'd be like 10 bucks, maybe 15 bucks.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't bother me because there was a special spot, and it was like the best spot in the whole hotel. It had like 50 foot ceilings and nice couches and an ocean view as I was like sipping my tea. And they would just let me stay there for hours. And so I would just stay there sometimes for 2 or 3 hours and just like hang out in the best spot, you know, sipping my tea and reading a book and just writing
sounds
in a journal.
Amazing.
Yeah, writing in a journal or something, right? And and it's like, I remember I took my wife there after we got married, and I had all these different spots I would go to that was like super cheap, like almost either free or super cheap, but that were just amazing, you know? That no one else knew about. And I could go anytime I want. I had like this long list of different places. But that type of stuff was like a lifesaver, you know. I couldn't understand why more people didn't take advantage of, you know, the ocean or the beach or certain places that you can access really cheaply. But yeah, I think nowadays, one of the things, like this past week, I was telling my wife, man, I feel kind of stressed. There are different times. I think this week was a stressful week because we were moving, so we finished the move. And we had a leak at our house. I spent the whole day with plumbers and remediation and all this crazy stuff.
Stressful.
And yeah, a lot of stressful stuff. And then the markets are going crazy and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then I feel this responsibility to like be kept up to date, you know, to know what's going on with stuff.
Yeah.
And as I start to feel stressed, what I naturally do is I go, you know, I've got to put my subconscious to work. Like, this is the way out. A lot of times I feel that way. And so what I do is right before I go to bed, rather than forgetting about my stress, I actually try to bring it up. I go, okay, what am I really stressed about? And then I will try to answer a question. So I'll actually like have a question in mind. And it's almost like I write that question in my head. Right. Mm-hmm. And this past week, like 2 days ago, actually, I think it might have been last night, but I said, okay, my whole thing is, you know, what do I really want in 10 years? Like 10 years from now, like what is it that, you know, is going to be really important for me? And how is that changing? How should that change my decisions today? Right. And so I just kind of wrote that in my head, you know, that question. And I made sure as I go to bed, I'm going to sleep, I'm just thinking about that question. I'm not trying to solve it at that moment. I'm just trying to let my subconscious take care of it. And I woke up a few times, you know, and I don't have that question in my head. So I put that question back in my head, like if I wake up. So my subconscious is still thinking about it. So I do that 2 or 3 times. And then I wake up in the morning. And it feels a little bit different, you know. It's like, and if I do that for a few nights, there's so much progress that's made, and so it's one of my ways where I think the question is like, you know, how can you escape a mental rut? If I were to just kind of suppress it, push it down, it could just really engulf me, you know, like like
I'll
stress and anxiety really can like debilitate people. It's really, I think, something to be concerned about. But and that's why I treat it very seriously. I'm like, if I got stress and anxiety, I've got to bring it up. I've got to deal with it. And I've got to make some changes in my life too, you know? And I'm willing to make those changes. Maybe I need to cut some stuff out. Maybe I need to change my goals or my ambitions, what I'm looking for, what I'm doing, et cetera. But everything's on the plate, actually, when I get anxious or stressed. I try to reevaluate kind of a lot of things. Good question, though.
Yeah, great.
Another question our follower says, Emmett discussed TSNP on the last podcast. I got hyped. So we need Emmett's insights and opinions on Humble, their new conference call. So for people who aren't following this, you know, was it a week or two ago you talked about Humble? They merged with, you know, they did a SPAC with
Tesonero or something.
Yeah, Tesonero.
Yeah, reverse merger. Or something like that. It wasn't a SPAC, but it's something a little different.
Yeah, it was a penny stock. And I think on Friday or something, they did a reverse stock split, 1-4, and they changed their ticker to TSNPD. They're going to change it to
HMBL.
HMBL. So yeah, I was watching a few of their presentations from their founders, and
Brian Foote.
What are your current thoughts on this company?
Yeah, I mean, I've researched it a little bit. I can't remember how I came across it. It's one of the many like stocks I was researching. And most stocks I researched, and I'm like, I'm very skeptical. I'm like, that's that. This could be that. Yeah. But something about this stock, when I watched their presentations early on, just caught my eye, like the story about how they did the reverse merger and the guy Brian Foote and the way he talks about things and his background with Amazon, like really successful there, and you know, the type of stuff he's done and the timelines they put out, they seem to meet all their timelines and or exceed them. But there's concerns I have about it too. You know, it's like I don't know. I think it's like $4 or $5 billion market cap. It's like, what the heck? This penny stock's a $5 billion market cap. Like, it's crazy. What's going on here? You know, that's like the big red flag to me. It doesn't mean it can't become much bigger, but it's not a penny stock that's like $100 million. That's going to go up 10x. You know, I mean, $5 billion to $50 billion. That's a pretty big step change. You know, and they don't even really have it's like another one of these companies, like a fintech play that doesn't really have a service that's really out there yet. That's really a lot of talk right now, but I still think, you know, I'm still excited about what comes out from this. It just seems a little expensive for me to go like heavy on in any shape, way or form, you know, just because it's such a high market cap right now. But I'm watching it closely, and they had their last presentation. They just bought Tickery, or they just merged or bought Tickery. I guess this, you know, competitor to like Ticketmaster. Well, Ticketmaster is like the big ticket e-ticket thing, but it's like the only one in town really. So they're trying to create a competitor that they think they'll do even better. And so if they can do that, you know, with mass transit tickets, concert tickets, sports tickets, all this stuff, and they can make it more seamless for people to do on their phone, I think that'll help. That's an interesting case to put forth. But overall, I think it's really a lot of it depends on, can this guy and his team deliver, you know, and it's going to depend on that. Can they execute and keep delivering and put a product out there that's really works well? They have this block FX or block ETX product. That's interesting. You have to get, you know, they might not be able to offer in the US or they're trying to figure that out. But they have lots of innovative ideas, and the way they talk about the Web 3.0 is really interesting to me. It seems, you know, they simplify it in a great way. So anyway, you watched some of their stuff too, Dave. I mean, I'm sure the market cap's ridiculously high for this, but minus their market cap, what do you think about it?
No, I think it was funny because I actually watched, you know, one of their presentations without looking at the market cap first. So I was like, you know, just open mind.
Good.
And I was like, hey, you know, these guys have some interesting ideas here, right? Like using the blockchain, peer-to-peer, like, you know, overseas payments and then getting merchants on board. They want to do everything, right? So I'm like, okay, you know. So I'm like, I'm expecting their market cap to be a couple hundred, maybe 100 million or something, right?
200 million at most.
Especially because,
like, over a billion.
Yeah, especially because they don't. They haven't released the product yet, right? They're just, it seems like. So I'm like, okay, so let's look at their stock price. I'm like, wait, is this a typo or something? $5 billion?
And, I know.
So I was like, wow, man, that's crazy. And then I looked at LinkedIn, and I oftentimes what I'll do is I'll go and find out how many people are in that company or in LinkedIn, right? So I typed in Humble and only like 15 people showed up. And so I'm like, wow, man, this is crazy, you know?
huge company, huge market cap.
Yeah, it's
a few dozen employees at most. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and I give them credit though; they've got a big, ambitious idea, you know. And I wish them the best. You know, if they can execute it,
yeah.
I just want to see more like real life adoption, you know, usage. And supposedly they're gonna, I think, start their rollout in Singapore or something, right? For less regulations, but it's definitely a company to watch. It's just I'm kind of wide eyed or in disbelief.
The market cap. Yeah. That's the big issue with me. I like it, but then I see the market. I just can't really compute it to be like, you know, I have a tiny position in my IRA account, but it's so small. I didn't want to put anything. Buy a tiny bit, but we'll see. It's up a little tiny bit, but we'll see. I don't know. I mean, I think they're building on top of Stripe's API, a lot of their stuff too. So, you know, Stripe obviously has a good backbone technology for them to use for some of their stuff. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
A lot of companies use Stripe.
Last question from a user, Sven Van Get says, love the chats between you. It's like a free university lecture filled with thoughts and experiences. I have a softball question. Are you a dog or cat person?
Yeah. I mean, I really want to get a golden retriever. Like I've dreamed of that since I was a kid, like a house with two kids, a beautiful wife and two kids. And I got three kids, got a nice house, got a nice, beautiful, incredible wife, but no golden retriever yet. And, that's on my list of things to get. We have cats. We have two cats.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They're easy to take care of. We've had, a couple small dogs in the past, but they're like, you know, when I met my wife, she had a Maltese poodle.
Oh, nice.
And it was small. It was like 6 pounds. And
I
used to have to go walk it at night and stuff in New York City. It was tiny. It wasn't like a man dog or anything. You know, it was like a girly, you know. And so it was like not the dog I wanted, but it was a cute dog and lots of energy. But I really want that big dog, you know, at some point. But it is work, you know, but it'll help me get my walks in, you know, for sure. Because then you got to walk the dog if you have a big one, for example, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, we'll see. Maybe in the next year or two, I'll get one.
Yeah.
Do you have any pets, Dave?
Yeah. I'm definitely more of a dog guy. We have like a small Yorkshire Terrier.
Okay.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Small dog, but man, that guy he's got a feisty personality. I mean, like he won't back down from nobody. You know, there'll be like some whatever, any dog out there, he will stand his ground, you know?
Wow.
But he's getting old. He's like probably 12 or 13 years old now. So he's slowed down and he's just chills all day and, you know, just does a few things. But,
It's funny. Speaking of pets, my granddad, when he came back from, World War II, he was like stationed in Africa or something like that. He brought a pet monkey with him.
Wow.
And, my grandma was like, "What are you doing?" Like they're married, you know, marriage. Like he just brought his pet monkey with him, and it lasted like a couple of days. He had to give it back because it was like on the, you know, a pet monkey is not a good idea. It sounds good, but that's something I've thought about in the past. But every story I've heard about pet monkeys does not end well.
Yeah.
Lots of poop flying around and
yeah.
Other things.
That
would be
like
cool to do a podcast with a little pet monkey on my shoulder.
It sounds like a full-time job just cleaning up the mess the monkey makes.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Cool, man. Anything going on next couple weeks for you?
Yeah, no, nothing really. Just nothing special. Hopefully going to Hawaii in April. I haven't worked out all the details, but for like a week, you know, as long as everything's going well with the lockdowns ending and stuff.
Yeah.
Other than that, nothing too crazy. Anything interesting with you?
No, just I'm actually planning my summer kind of travels. So, I'm tempted to do, like, we're going to do some RV travels. We've got a Yosemite reservation and stuff, but One of the issues was last summer, it was really hard to get internet. Even with a satellite dish, like half the time I couldn't get reception, and Starlink isn't mobile right now. And so if I'm in an RV for a prolonged time, then I won't be able to do much in terms of YouTube or interviews or anything. And I think last year I felt, you know, more just free with that. This year I feel a little bit more responsibility to folks to at least keep up to date, and to, I feel there's like a kind of, it's kind of weird, but I feel like a metaphysical relationship between, you know, the subscribers, where I feel this sense of
responsibility.
Like, yeah. It's almost like a third child, you know, like to take care of in a way, and to not forget. And so kind of has changed since last year. You know, last year I felt like it wasn't a child. It was more of a pet. You can leave it at someone else's house, you know?
This year,
I feel like...
I have like 125, more than 125,000 subscribers, I think. Right?
Yeah.
This
year it feels more, I need to take them with me, you know, with the family. And so it's starting to factor into some of my travel plans, but we'll see. Otherwise,
what if you could do like shorter ones on your phone that doesn't have to be as good quality, but like, I don't know, just keep in touch and give an update on stuff for like what you think's going on with Tesla and XYZ developments or the markets.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be like the long form interviews all the, you know, if you're traveling and don't have good internet, you know.
You know, maybe I'll do that. Like maybe if I'm like out of reception or something, like depending on what you're doing, but maybe I'll ask you to fill in or something.
Sure.
Yeah,
maybe I can.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I'll be like your backup. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. All right. I mean, nice chatting with you as always.
All right.
Great weekend.
You too.
We'll keep in touch, man. Okay.
All right. Yeah.